Alice Wheeldon, welcome back to Cheological.
Thank you. Lovely to be back.
I'm happy to have you back. So we had a conversation quite recently that is already up, so y'all can go listen to that over on the mainstream. And at the end of that conversation, which is often the case with these podcast conversations, something comes up and, you know, we kind of both go, ooh, there's something there. Well, let's just leave that for another conversation. And so we're back with that today. And the thing that really caught our attention last time was this phrase, this question, what's the cost of the medical model? Now, I think it was you who said that. And I remember thinking to myself, what a great question, because usually in our particular corner of the world with our complementary or alternative or non-standard or whatever you want to call it type medicine, we talk about the problems of the medical model. We talk about how maybe it's not complete or the right thing, but I've never heard anyone say, what's the cost of the medical model?
I guess that's a cue for me to think more about it. And of course, I then went away and had a really good look at it again, because it's a big topic. And people have been talking about this and the problems, as you say, of the medical model for decades. It's not new. But I've had this strong feeling that we pay a this is complicated, because of course, there's a lot to be said for it. There's a lot to be said for the medical model, so I'm not throwing it
absolutely, yes.
So I just want to say that to begin with. But for some of us, it feels like a cost that we pay to try and squeeze ourselves into it. So that's where I'm coming from.
The cost that we pay to squeeze ourselves into.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was looking, well, what is the medical model? I was going back to basics and thinking, well, just checking, really. I got it right. The medical model is really, in its most basic, diagnosis and treatment. And, you know, I think most people listening to this will be engaged in some way in diagnostics and treatment. And there's a lot to be said for that. And it kind of works, doesn't it?
When I think of diagnostics and treatment, I am thinking of a way of charting a territory. Somebody comes in, something's going on. The question is always, well, I'd like to help, but before I can help, I have to have a sense of what is this?
Yeah, we do. I mean, of course we do. People come to us for help, don't they? And they have it in mind that's what they've come for. I want help. I've got a problem with my back. And I want help with it. What's wrong with that? Nothing is wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with saying, okay, let's have a look at you and let's see if I can help you. There's nothing wrong with it. But there have been a lot of critiques, as you said at the beginning, of the medical model over the years, particularly in mental health, actually, and disability, where, you know, it's often opposed to the social model, which is really saying, well, you know, disabled people are not disabled by society. There's nothing wrong with them. It's society that doesn't recognize or support their particular way of being. So they're putting the problem back on society and saying the medical problem is a problem. But that's not quite what I mean by it being problematic. I don't think it's problematic in itself. It has a kind of logic. It kind of works. But what I have come to in my work is that you can't squeeze what I am doing into the medical model. It's very so tempting. I was on the peripheral of the shiatsu world. I was very much involved at one stage. And of course, there's a tremendous desire to say, well, what we do is valuable. And in a wider medical context, and you guys need to pay attention to us. We've got something real to offer. So let's see if we can explain it in your terms. Let's try and explain it in terms of the medical model. So on the one hand, for what I do, certainly it doesn't work to do that. it changes what we do to do that. But I will acknowledge, of course, it's important to acknowledge that this has been questioned for quite a while, isn't it? Especially with the mindfulness movement. You know, maybe the real question is, does it work? That, in a sense, is the medical model. It's diagnosing something. Does it work? Does the treatment work?
Well, and how do you know it works? And what are we measuring?
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, this is all work in progress, I have to say. But I wonder, even asking those questions about does it work, how do we measure that, what is it we're asking, really, is all within the medical model usually. It's all we're saying, okay, but lots of other things work too. I mean, I think classically that the medical model has been criticized heavily for being reductivist, you know, to reducing us to just bodies. And some medicine does that. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It does reduce us to bodies. If you've ever been through the sausage machine sort of factory of the national health system in the UK, you know, you're reduced to a body, and sometimes it's helpful and quite often it's semi-helpful. And that's the medical model at its most basic. And I think we're right to question that. With trying to squeeze what we do, well, I should say, and even that's problematic, isn't it? What we do. You know, there are a lot of people listening to this, I'm sure, who do all sorts of different things. So I should better say what I do, really. Squeezing that into diagnosis and treatment isn't possible, because diagnosis and treatment are the same thing. And I think that's more in line, if you want to look at something more mainstream, it's more in line with some views in psychotherapy, where it's really the dynamic between the person that's important. And we can't say exactly what the magic is in that when it does work. What is that? So it's my question is more akin to that sort of question. But then I said, well, what's the cost? And that's, I suppose, where I'm really interested in the, it's not just, oh, do we squeeze it in? Can we squeeze it in? Do we shift the medical model? But in fact, should we be trying? I'm not so sure myself. But I think it's good to be aware of the problems. It's good to be aware of what the medical model is. But when you recognize how somebody is, and this goes back to what we were talking about before, how it is for someone, that is the treatment. So if I go on and take that further and say, oh, I see how it is for you and this, and now I'm going to do this to you, I've lost it. I've lost the moment. I've lost what actually helps. And if I try and technique that, if I try and see how it is for you as a technique for changing you, making you better, I've lost it again. Because it looked like I was really trying to get you, but actually I was really trying to change you.
Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a manipulation.
It does. I mean, I can sort of hear almost myself, but other people saying, oh, but I've had a lot of these conversations before. Oh, but no, but that's not what we do. That's not what we're trying to help people. We're really not trying to manipulate them. But that's not what I see. The moment you technique it, you're manipulating someone.
Well, I want to stand up from manipulating for just a moment.
Good.
I just want to see where this goes, because everything that you've said, I'm kind of sitting here, I'm nodding my head, and I find it delicious. I really do. To hear you talk about, and we talked about this, that there's a kind of this-ness that arises in the interaction. And when we are with that, things happen. We can open to it. We can invite it, whether it shows up or not. Well, we just have to see. And when it shows up, then we have to, you know, then we have this opportunity. Oh, so it showed up and now I'm going to do something to it. Or we just stay in that appreciation and see what unfolds next. And so I hear that. I've had some experience with that. Those for me are often moments in clinic where I really sit like at the feet of something way bigger than me. And I am moved to do whatever I do, but I'm not thinking that I should do something. And in those moments, they can occur. They cannot be forced. They can only be invited. And they can be very profound. If I could every day sit in the presence of that, that, you know, that makes for a good day. Sometimes it shows up, sometimes it doesn't. So that being said, you know, I just want to express my appreciation for whatever that unnameable thing is. I mean, we're talking around something because I don't think it's possible to quite name it. You can speak to aspects of it. You can catch a glimmer of it. But to encompass the whole thing, you have to leave language. And then there's no conversational podcast to be had. So we're exploring around the edges, wherever those edges are, about what this is. So that being said, I want to come back to manipulation, because there's this part of me that is also in the room, that is also present, that also is involved in helping people, and they come in and they want to be different. And you know what? I want them to be different, right? I'm just going to stand up for that part. That's like, yeah, you're like this, but you know what? I don't want you to be such an asshole. I want you to be nicer to your children. I want you to feel more comfortable in your own skin. I want you to be able to come up to, you know, a box of chocolate chip cookies and go, yeah, not for me. Right? There's all kinds of things I would like for my patients, because in my experience of them, I know that it's what they also want for themselves. And I want to do what I can to help them get there. And if I can manipulate something in their physiology so they lose their sweet tooth or so they're dialed back on their reactivity, I'm going to do that if I can, because I want them to be different. So that stands in stark juxtaposition to what we just said. There's the part of me that stands up for that, really sitting at the feet of the numinous experience. And there's a part of me that wants to get in there. It's like, oh, I see where this cog is stuck and I can pull this lever and free that thing up, and I'm going to do it. So there's that as well.
Yes, I recognize all that. And it's not like I exactly disagree with you. See, I think this is a really interesting bit. I don't, and I do disagree with you at the same time, because...
Yeah, I do and don't disagree with me as well.
You get to that place where you can see, ah, there's a point of change here. And I give my attention to that point of change. I give my attention. But I still contend that the moment I start doing it, doing something to that point of attention, I've lost it. I've squashed it. And I mean, I acknowledge, you know, you can, I can go and have a manipulative technique done, and sometimes it kind of helps. That's fine. I don't have any disagreement with that. I think the medical model has its real uses. And sometimes people can do stuff to me that I want and appreciate, and it helps.
Yes, thank you for drilling my tooth, pulling out the rotten part.
Yeah.
And helping the pain go away. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. I don't have any disagreement with that. But that's not usually changing a fundamental distortion of ourselves. It's helping. It's taking off the worst of it. It's allowing us to continue a bit longer. And then at its best, I would say it's bringing consciousness to that thing, that stuck muscle, that thing. And when you bring another person's consciousness to it and we awake to it, we can, then something can change deeply sometimes when attention is drawn to it. But I think there's a deeper level of, I'm going to use the word medicine with a slight sort of, not sure I like it, but I'm going to use it. I think there's a deeper kind of medicine that we're kind of aiming for, and which the medical model doesn't touch. And that is partly about ideology. It's partly about what we think we're here for. and what health is. But it's also, you know, about everyday health and well-being, not just the bigger picture, but not just the macro, but the micro as well. And I suggest it's more effective. You and I were talking just before we were recording about the situation we're all in here. Our ideologies are failing us. Our way of seeing things are failing us. It's always been the job of those marginal people like us, because, you know, hey, I'm still pretty marginal in terms of the medical professions, very marginal, to challenge the mainstream. I don't want to be part of the medical model because it's not where I'm at. It's too small for me. I'm not interested. And it's going to be a problem for me if I... So tempting to go, oh, well, I could put it in your terms and let's see if we can work together. I'm not sure I want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to squeeze the, I'm thinking of like the, what do you call it? Is it the iris of a camera? Like you can open up a camera's lens or close it down. The aperture. We have to squeeze the aperture down so much to fit in the medical model. And that means that we have to leave outside all these other aspects of what the kind of medicine we practice can bring. Now we've got a bunch of tools in our kit. We're not allowed to bring them in here because there's no language for it. There's no room for it. And this, for me, gets into a thing. It has to do with acceptance. And a lot of it has to do with my own sense of, do I trust what I'm doing? Because I can remember early on when I first got out of school, I very much wanted to be seen as like real. I wanted to be seen as reliable. And so I kind of cozied up to the medical model because, well, everybody believes in the medical model. This is what medicine is. And if I can kind of carry the scent of that in my work, then I will be more believable and I will be more digestible to people that might want to come in.
Yeah, more plausible.
Right? More plausible. Yeah. And as time has gone on, I have slowly grown over the years away from that, mostly because I trust the work that I do, and I don't feel like I need to lean on the medical model for my credibility. That's the word I was looking for. I cozied up to the medical model because I thought it gave me credibility, and it will give you credibility. But what happens if you do your work long enough and you come across the kinds of things that we talked about in our last podcast and that we're alluding to and speaking to now that you can't speak to directly, but you can, you know, we can pull out these wisps and snippets like, you know, a good piece of poetry will remind you of something. And that holds no credibility in that model. And yet, for anyone who's been in practice long enough to sit in those moments of, oh, this, then we know that it's there and we know that it's possible. A lot of this, I think, is the journey of us as practitioners.
It is. There is a subject here that's enormous because it's also about training, what we're training people to do here, if we're training people, if that's what we're involved in as well. For me, this is also, I'm not training people to do techniques. I'm training them to be people who are open to other people and not come with an agenda. We've got such a tricky thing going on here, haven't we? Because what I'm asking people to do in workshops or whatever is to drop their agenda, but they've come with an agenda, which is legitimate. They want to learn something, and people are coming to them with an agenda. They want to be better.
Yes. It's part of the economic deal that we've struck with each other.
It's a fair deal. It's a contract. Mm-hmm. It's a contract. Okay. And I do want to help people. I mean, there's no getting around it. That's kind of what the job is, really, isn't it? What is help here again?
Hang on for just one moment. That question, right there. What is help? So I just heard you pose that question, and something inside of me just went, oh, wow, wait a minute. I've been working at this for 20 some odd years. I don't know if I've spent much time sitting with that question of what is help. That is a deliciously uncomfortable question.
It's crucial, isn't it? It's crucial to what we do. I'm noticing more and more that people are becoming educated in what feels like help, because we have an idea of what help is. I'm going to get my arm fixed, I'm going to get my shoulder fixed, and that's help. But, you know, to me, it doesn't feel like help anymore. It's not like I won't sometimes go for that kind of help. You know, I have a sore shoulder. I have a somewhat painful shoulder at the moment. I can go to it for help, but it doesn't really help. What really helped me, and this is back to when we were talking last time, when I met my teacher, Kishi, is being got. That helps, and it sounds such a simple thing to do. I don't think it's simple to get people, and I don't think it's easy to feel got. This is so simple, but so difficult again to do. And the medical model, is it going to help us? I mean, in terms of feeling got. Now, sometimes it does, because sometimes if you get a diagnosis, I mean, there's plenty of research on this, the relief alone can be an enormous help. The help that you can get if you're told you're dyslexic, for instance. Okay, well, it's not so nice, but I can go out and get some help now. I can go out and sort the problem out because I know what the problem is.
Well, people think they know what the problem is.
Well, fair. Fair enough. But there is a certain amount of research suggesting that diagnosis sometimes helps in itself. It can move the conversation on.
Yes, I would agree. There's something I've noticed over the years, you know, the kind of work we do, we often see people who have really oddball things. Nobody knows what's going on with them. That's why they end up in our offices. And I have heard people say this again and again and again. I've heard them say, I just want to know what it is. I've even had people say, I don't care if it's cancer. I just want to know what it is.
Yeah, so I acknowledge that that kind of approach can have a therapeutic effect, just to know, as you say, just to know.
Well, I think it also points to this deep sense that people, and I'm including myself in people, have of wanting to feel like we make sense to ourselves and make sense to the world. And when this thing is not right, we don't know how to orient to ourselves or the world. It's really, in many ways, a question of, I mean, this will sound trite as I say it, but I don't mean it in a trite way, of who am I and where am I going?
Yeah. Well, I actually think that's crucial that you hit the nail on the head. It is about that. I mean, sometimes I think this is crazy. What am I doing? You know, why don't I know what's wrong with me? That in itself is sort of insanity at some level. And so people come to us, come to me here, and they, you know, say, what's wrong with me? And I do sometimes feel like laughing and say, well, you know, isn't it obvious? Look at the way you're living your life. Why don't you know? That's, in a way, we do stop then at diagnosis. I want to stop at diagnosis. And my job is to show them a mirror. My job is to bring consciousness to their condition. And it works. It works profoundly. But it doesn't necessarily work in ways we think it's going to work.
Yes.
So that's a tricky one. We want to get better, but what is that? What would getting better be? We don't often stop to wonder. We just assume that the thing we have that's uncomfortable, we don't want. I remember some years ago asking a client with back pain. Persistent it was. It was just persistent. And I just, one day I just said to her, do you want this back pain to go? And she paused. She said, no, I wouldn't know what to do without it. Which I find rather interesting.
I've been trying to get rid of this for years. Thank God it stuck around because I don't know what I would do without it. It's a very loyal friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Where would I put my energy if I didn't have this back pain? What would I?
What else would I have to do with my life?
Yeah. What would I have to say, actually, if I wasn't saying it this way? So, I mean, we veered into huge questions here. I suppose.
We started with a huge question.
Yeah, we did through the medical. but for me, the cost of the medical model from, if I were to just try and squeeze it in, is to destroy what I'm doing. That bad. The cost is that high. Because it would be to technique what I'm doing, to not be with this person in this moment, but to say, actually, there's a technique. Yes, this does help, but I can't make that into a formula for help. I was thinking of Hume, the philosopher Hume, about 18th century, saying, you know, there's no such thing as cause and effect. And that for me, that's true. At the moment we think there's cause and effect in terms of treatment, diagnosis and treatment, we've reduced it down to a mechanism, a repeatable mechanism, which of course is what we want medicine to be, what science wants medicine to be. We'd like that. And it would make life awfully simple. Wouldn't that be marvelous? And of course, sometimes it's true, you know, the cause and effect do seem to be fairly reliable. But I think when you come to sort of the complexities that we see in it with our actual clients, yeah, it's just not like that. You know, their lives are a sort of web of aspects of distortion, and the light needs to be shone on that. And that's what we do together, the clients and me. We shine a light on that, and something changes. But I would say that I usually don't know what that change is going to be. I'm often surprised by what people tell me has changed.
For me, when I am surprised by what has changed for a patient, it kind of lets me know that I'm on, I don't know if the word right track is the correct way to say it, but that I'm kind of on the beam with what we're talking about. Because like, oh, well, that's interesting and that's unexpected. You know, it doesn't fit in like the flow chart of how I would otherwise be thinking about things. I feel like it's like navigating to somewhere. I went sailing the other day with some friends. And the delightful thing about sailing is you've got a destination that you're heading to. But every moment as the wind blows and shifts and the water's like this or the waves are like that and the boat's heeled at this angle or that angle, every moment is this tiny little connection with that moment that's taking you to a destination, but every moment is slightly different from the other. And as you look at a boat moving across the water, it's just, you know, moving along. You know, it looks like one continual thing, but it really is strung together with constant changing conditions where these little adjustments are happening. And it feels like treatment, I'm even reluctant to use the word treatment at this moment as we're having this conversation. But, you know, in being with a patient to do the work that we're doing, it's often like that. These little moments of this, of that, of this change, that change, something unexpected, and how you react to it is equally as part of a treatment as that you put the needle in the right place or you chose to work on this arm to fix that leg, you know, fix, to influence that leg.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and at the same time, hang on, I got one more thing to say. I'm on a roll here. So you talked about this web and this web of distortion. And I love that image. I don't completely understand it, but I hear you say it and I go, ooh, that's something to invite into the clinic and you know, to look for it, to see where is it? Can I see that? Can I interact with that? You know, I like that. It's not an ABC kind of thing. It's an invitation to inquire. So we have the web, but of course, with any web, you've got these nodal places. And you can work on a node and that will affect the web, or you can work on the web and that will affect the nodes.
It's also a dance. I want to stand back from my clients. I want to not have the stance of a forward stance of doing something, a forward stance of I'm the one who's doing something here. I mean, it sounds so, even saying it to me, I think, oh, but you know, they're coming to me. I'm meant to be doing something. But actually, if I just drop that and I'm there with them and hang back, and I'm not looking for that web, or I'm not looking for nodes or places of, I would probably say points of fulcrum points, maybe. They're there, but if I go looking for them, they vanish. The person has to come to me in more ways than just walking up my stairs here. I have to be open to them, really open. I'm back to the agenda here. If you're really open to somebody, you have to drop the agenda. I find this really interesting for me, is that I can't be open and have an agenda of helping this person. I can't be open and have any real agenda except the basic form which holds me. The basic form, they've come to me, they lie down. I sit there. This is the basic form which I don't question, which is honed and as neutral as can be, as agenda-free, if you like, because one could question that, as could be. And then I invite them, all of them, and those points appear. But if I go looking for them, it's different. And I think for me that even the question what works is going in the opposite direction from that. It's looking, it's searching, it's trying to do something. And this comes back to me again to this thing, you can't technique being with someone. You can't technique the realness of relating, of resonance, of inviting them, of being open to them as they really are. Can't technique that. So I want us to do something different, really. I want us to say, as a body, as a group, hey, you know, the medics, you're great, you're lovely. We love you, you carry on doing your thing. We're doing something really different here. And we've got a completely different way of seeing how it is. And, you know, our idea of help and fulfillment and health is maybe in some respects a bit different from yours. And we're going to stand up and be able to say that with clarity and pride. And I suppose not feel that, oh dear, we're on the periphery. We've got to somehow find a way to get the medics to talk to us, because they're the ones with the power, they're the ones with the money, and we need to go in their direction. I want to be so effective in not doing that, so attractive in not doing that, that they start to go, what's going on over there? What is it that everyone loves over there?
Okay, so this gets to a point of mine that I've been noodling on for a long time now. First of all, there's something to be said for being at the periphery and just inhabiting that, being happy to be at the periphery, because it's here at the periphery that this kind of work can happen. So there's that. For myself, there's a sense of okayness with that. I am not in the mainstream. I'm actually happy to not be in the mainstream. I don't even want to be in the mainstream. Now, there are other people, they want to be in the mainstream, and I think that's great. Go be in the mainstream. But there is something for being at the periphery. The thing about, it just ran out of my mind. It's tricky catching the wisps of this kind of a conversation. It'll come back to me at some point. So I'll just carry on with the next thought, which is the being with piece versus the doing something to. Of course, you know, and we've talked about this, that the agreement in medicine is I'm going to do something to you to help reduce your suffering. And, you know, often patients will make the very large logistical error of thinking I've taken away their back pain. Oh, you got rid of my back pain. Now help me with my, you know, whatever else. And I'm pretty clear at this point. I don't get rid of anybody's anything. Because partly out of self-defense, I realized a while back that if I'm going to take responsibility for getting rid of their back pain, then I have to take an equal amount of responsibility for things not working, which can be very burdensome on a practitioner. We like to feel like we're being helpful. And, you know, I'm not abdicating responsibility here to say I'm not responsible for, you know, them not getting better. But at the same time, if I'm going to take responsibility for them getting better, air quotes here, getting better, then I have to take equal responsibility for them not getting better. Both of those are a bit of a burden. We do what we do to the best degree that we can. Something happens inside of the people that we're working with. And it is a bit mysterious. And when you talk about recognizing and having an appreciation for the web of who they are, including its distortions, and some curiosity about it. Oh, that's a whole different world to sit inside of. And it's a journey that the practitioner and patient sort of go on together. It's more of a co-creation than the practitioner is manipulating the patient.
Yes. People commonly do say, oh, this feels different. This feels like we're doing this together. This doesn't feel like I'm being done to. And I like that. So there's a lot of feedback like that. It's a taste that people develop for a different way of doing things. And that takes me back to your mainstream point, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of freedom, you know, perhaps we're avant-garde. It'd be kind of exciting to think of ourselves, and I think we are in some ways. But, you know, we, in some form or another, have been around for hundreds of years, that this seems to be the way it is, that there is a periphery. And I'm not sure. I wonder if, in fact, the medical model, I'd quite like to be a bit more mainstream in some ways, but not on those terms, not on the medical model terms.
This is something I think I've seen. There's a lot of talk. I don't know about over there in Great Britain where you live, but I know here in the States there's a lot of talk about integrative medicine and that we want to get into the conventional system. We want to be accepted by the conventional system. We want our techniques and our medicine to be a part of the greater system of, you know, medicine, with an air quotes here, covered by insurance and, you know, everything and all that. And it's occurred to me, you know, especially with COVID-19, it's like any talk of Chinese medicine being included in what's going on with COVID, it's like out the window. Whereas before, there seemed to be this tenuous connection. Oh, yeah, we can all work together. It's like push comes to shove. No, it's the medical model. And it seems to me, from where I stand at this moment in time as we're having this conversation, of course, that perspective could change at any moment, that the medical system, I'm going to call it the conventional system, it would like to have our techniques, but it doesn't want our perspective. But without our perspective, our techniques are, you can use them to some degree, but they are hollow and they're not nearly, as in Chinese, they would say, linghua. They're not lively and engaged.
Yeah, I completely agree. We are like a Trojan horse in the medical system, I think. It's like my mindfulness. It's like, oh yeah, let's use mindfulness. Do you really think you could use this thing and not have it explode inside your system? I mean, it's such a different perspective. And it's not just a different perspective. It brings a different reality with it. Because as soon as you sit and you're mindful, you recognize, oh, I'm not my body. Oh, I'm not even my mind. I'm not these things. So who am I? What am I? You're immediately questioning the dominant ideology. So I'm not suggesting that we should have anything integrated. I don't want to integrate, really. I just want to be in charge. I want a more basic revolution than that. I don't want to be particularly in charge, but I don't think they're compatible in some ways, these ways of seeing things.
I think these worldviews might not be compatible. And if we're going to somehow squish them together, well, which perspective is going to lose what aspect of itself? Because they don't connect like a lock and a key.
They don't. I don't know. In some ways, I think what we do can't be huge, because it is about, as you've sort of implied a few times, it is partly about the maturity of the practitioner. It's about developing. And, you know, quick fixes rely on techniques. So we're talking about very different things. But there is, back to the point of this, that there is a high cost to us fitting ourselves in, unless you like the medical model, unless, you know, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of people work with the medical model and are happy with it and like it, see themselves as fixing people. And it's a clear contract, it's clean, and you know, to some extent it works.
Yeah, there's some techniques that work really well.
Yeah.
You can help a lot of people.
You can help people.
Maybe you're not helping with the network, but you're certainly helping out a particular node. Yeah. Changing any node on a network will also change the network.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, we can come at it in, you know, from these different, do I want to say leverage points? You used the word fulcrum earlier.
Yeah. I don't know, because I mean, I still want to say they're different models, well, and that they're not compatible. But I suppose I would say that you choose your model. You choose what you are doing. You're conscious of what you're doing, and you go for it. But for me, it's certainly in my business, the business of touch, there's a woolly gray area. I'm mixing my metaphors a little bit there, but where we kind of want to use the medical model, but we want to do what we want to do too. And then nobody knows what they're doing. Nobody quite knows what the contract is here. Am I trying to change people, or am I just trying to help them self-develop?
Yes. You just put your finger on something that to me is something that I know, word's not struggle, but I'm aware of, that people have come to me with a certain contract. And yet, as we get into the work itself, maybe I'm completely not interested in that frozen shoulder of theirs, because there's all this other stuff that has my attention. It's not that I'm leaving the shoulder out, but it's like, what's the best way to treat that shoulder? Well, maybe there's all these other aspects. It gets hard to explain. I'm going to come at it from a different angle. I had a patient years ago who, I can't even remember what she came in for. Doesn't even matter at this point. But we somehow got to talking about her life and the life that she's had an opportunity to live, doing amazing work that she loved to do. That took like all her time, and like relationships that she had in her life. And she was frustrated that the person she loved the most, she couldn't have in her life full time. And something in me clicked, and I went, wow, that's great. I mean, how perfect could that be, that the person you love the most, you couldn't have them full time? I mean, there was something right about saying that. I just said it. I didn't think it. It was just like, bang, I said it. She was furious with me. How dare you, right? Love of my life, I don't get to have them full time. And it didn't move me. The fury that she had did not move me. I just was able to come back and go, it gave you all this time to do this other thing that was so important to you. I don't know where that came from. It just came out, and the room got still.
Wow.
Maybe a super great psychotherapist could technique that. I don't know. I'm not a psychotherapist. I mean, I don't have an interest in that realm. What I'm describing here is a moment of recognition of something that came out, and it was partly her and her experience and partly me and my experience, and just this moment of appreciation and thisness that you were talking about earlier. And that when it arrives, you just sit and observe it unfolding. I mean, in some ways, there is nothing to be done.
Mm.
It sounds very Tao Te Ching. There's nothing to be done, and so everything gets done.
Yeah. Many of us are fond of quoting the Tao Te Ching, but do we actually live like that? No.
It's hard to live that way. I mean, the Tao Te Ching is, yeah. But it is helpful in a moment like this. It's like, oh gosh, okay, maybe that's what it means.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working towards, I mean, we do need a lot more stillness. I mean, I live in London and we really could do with some more stillness. Just looking at how we live our lives, something's got to change. I want to change how we do medicine. I want to change how we see what it's all about. We're not looking for a quick fix. Life's a process. And having some kind of sickness, I mean, it is trite in a way, but it is a process. It's a process. Why are you sick? Why are you still sick? It's a process. And it's my job to, it's like people are stuck in a dance move. That's what it feels sometimes. They come and they're like stuck. They keep doing this dance move and they can't get out of it. They just keep repeating it. And it's like your job is to kind of somehow join their dance and dance out of it, or dance with them.
Well, I find too sometimes, yes, join that dance. They come with something that they don't like. They want to get rid of it. One of the things I've learned over the years is it's hard to get rid of things for people because, number one, it's their job, not my job. But sometimes I will invite people into an inquiry, or I'll just point out to people that, like, oh, this thing that you've got, it's very loyal to you. What is this thing? It seems to be very loyal. It's not going away. I wonder what else is here. Right? How would you be if you didn't have this? I'm thinking about the person you were talking about earlier in this conversation. Well, if I didn't have that back pain, then I can't imagine living without it. It helps me, like, not go to parties when I don't want to go. It helps me, you know, connect with people because I can complain about what's going on. I mean, in some ways, it's bringing something useful to that person's life. And how can we, without blaming people, develop an appreciation for the suffering of the person and the suffering of that part that is so loyal that it's not going away until its sort of gift is received?
Yeah, until it's heard.
Until it's heard.
Yeah. And that comes back to, you know, our real job is to get it. Is to hear people so openly that they actually get heard. I mean, they actually feel heard. I mean, people can be quite surprised when they're actually heard. And I'm sure we've all had this. No one's ever listened to me say that before. And wow, that's huge. Surely 90% of our physical ills are rooted in emotional and psychological issues. So, you know, what are we doing to people trying to fix them, fix their bodies? I don't know.
As I hear you say it, I actually have this sense of, oh, maybe we're just tightening the knot.
Mm.
What if we're tightening the knot instead of loosening it with what we do?
Ooh, very good point. In shiatsu, if you press, you're actually anesthetizing. You're not releasing. You're locking things in sometimes, or what you do. Playing along with the drama is another way of seeing it. Yeah, it makes it very serious, putting it like that.
Well, I've wondered this over the years because really good Chinese doctors are supposed to kind of see who a person is and how a person is and how their symptomology is indicative of a trajectory that they're on. And our job is to shift their trajectory. But what if what I do today that gives them relief in this moment allows them to continue injuring themselves in another way that 5 years down the road makes for a worse situation? It's hard to see that. I mean, I don't think the conscious mind can really make sense of that stuff. But it's been in the back of my mind. Is getting rid of this person's back pain in their highest good? Have I actually helped? I sometimes wonder about that.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it's the stuff that wakes me up in the middle of the night. Did I really help? I felt good about what I did. They felt good about what I did. I wonder if I really helped.
Yeah. Did their life change? When somebody really changes, it feels strange as well. And I think that that's something we often, oh dear, you know, we've done something wrong there because there's a strange feeling. So perhaps we all need to educate ourselves a bit more about what real change is. What would that look like? Real change, fundamental change.
There is a strangeness about it. I mean, in those moments, as it begins to unfold or unwind, there is a strangeness. I would say when I think back on experiences like we're talking about and those kind of changes have occurred, something odd is going on. It's notable. It's palpable. Something's happening. And it is strange.
You know, I come back to education here. You know, we do 3-4 years of training. We're not really equipped to really be with people in that kind of change because it can be a bit scary. And to hold that space and to be with them when it's uncomfortable. We talk about healing crises and things, but do we really understand that? Do we understand how difficult that can be? Wisdom, we need to foster wisdom. It's quite hard to do that, isn't it? Not obvious. You can't choose to be wise. Right, if only you could.
Well, if you could choose to be wise, that wouldn't be wisdom, would it?
No.
I mean, you can't choose it. You know, I mean, it brings up another question for me, which is like, what's the difference between knowledge and wisdom?
Oh, yes. Big difference.
It's another whole can of worms.
Potentially big difference. I suppose that gets to Socrates, isn't it? He knew he was wise because he knew nothing.
Well, I have found in my time practicing medicine, I thought I would know a whole lot more than I do at this point. I really thought I would know and understand a lot more at this phase of my practice. And I often feel disappointed because of that. And then I also look at what I've learned over the time of doing the work that I've done, and I'm shocked at the amount of what I've learned, and at the same time, disappointed at how little I've learned. And both those things are true.
Yeah. I feel as if I know less and less and kind of more and more, but in completely different realms. I know less stuff, for sure. But that's partly because I allow it to fall out of my head quite happily. But it really is learning still to sit back and withhold the agenda, rein it in, and really just listen to what people are coming for, really what they're doing. And I've been in this work one way or another for decades, and it was just the other day I was working with a client, and I suddenly thought, oh my God, I'm actually not really open. I want to fix her still. What am I doing? And I dropped it as well as I could. But it seems to me that one's own agenda well, I speak for myself anyway, is a tricky little beast because you think you've dealt with it and it keeps coming back. There are depths, and it's not just a case of deciding to be open or deciding not to have an agenda. You have one as a human being, and it's your job to somehow erase it, slowly erode it. I think that's what I mean, erode it with knowing it doesn't work, with the fool that it is, the fool that my agenda is. Just I keep having to recognize it again and again. It's not a quick process.
Well, my suspicion is that process, much like a mindfulness practice, it's not that you get it and you've got it. It's that, oh, there it is. There it is. Oh, there it is. Missed it. Back. You know, that whole idea of using mindfulness to, like, well, I'm going to use mindfulness to get my anxiety under control so I can stay in this job that I can't stand. It's not a helpful use of mindfulness. You know, like you were saying, mindfulness can be dangerous because you might realize, oh my God, this job is at the core of my discomfort. Now what do I do? Right? You can't use mindfulness as an antidepressant. It's not going to help.
Well, yeah. I mean, it works quite well as an antidepressant, on the other hand. The National Health Service is using it for exactly that. It seems to be helping people. I get your point. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, I hear myself talking, I'm thinking, oh, yes, that sounds great. As long as we're all wise and ancient, we can be practitioners. But there's got to be a place for people starting out. And I think, of course, there is, because anyone coming with the right, for the attitude of service and openness to others and a willingness to be open to their own agenda is helping. It's the attitude you take that can help. And sure, years of practice hones that and perhaps makes you a better space to come into and see more clearly, help more quickly. But really, it's the same. And you don't have to be a brilliant, you don't have to have been doing this long to be helpful, if that is your agenda, to not have an agenda.
Well, there's a piece of work for us all to do, the agenda of not having an agenda. That sounds like a great place to wind this conversation down. I love that we've started with this question. We have absolutely no answers. We have managed to spend an hour looking into this thing like you would look into a multifaceted gem, you know, and see different aspects. I come away with many more questions than answers. And I'm really appreciative of you, Alice, for having this conversation, because I find that the questions almost always open things up in a much more effective way than answers, which tend to close things down.
Mm. Yes. Very good end. Very good end. The answers that close us down, indeed they do.
Yeah. So thank you so much for noodling through this, and we may have to come back together at some point and continue this sort of meandering, you know, we'll have the agenda of being agendaless. The agendaless agenda. There's a name for a book.
Thank you.